the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and Brian Lynn. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Anna Mateo.
When we eat some popular kinds of shellfish, namely clams, mussels, and oysters, we leave behind large amounts of shells. Instead of throwing these shells into the trash, several projects around the United States now aim to put these shells back into waterways. The goal is to restore or bring back the natural environment, a process called ecological restoration. In his article for the Associated Press, writer Wayne Perry describes this restoration as the seafood circle of life. In the U.S. and around the world, shells discarded at restaurants and other businesses are being collected, cleaned, and thrown back into waterways. The shells form a base for new colonies of sea creatures and help to protect coastlines. One of the latest projects with oysters takes place in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Some businesses there save the shells. The state's Department of Environmental Protection, or DEP, collects them. Then workers and volunteers with Rutgers and Stockton universities cooperate with the Jetty Rock Foundation to load them onto boats and put them into the state's Mullica River. Those shells go back into the water to help form new or expanded oyster colonies. Free-floating baby oysters, known as spat, connect to the shells and grow on them. The Mullica River is home to one of the last self-sustaining oyster populations on the Atlantic coast, said Sean LaTourette. He is New Jersey's leading environmental official. Scott Stuber is a fish biologist with the Department of Environmental Protection. He told the AP the ecological restoration project has already kept about 60,000 kilograms of shells out of landfills. It has also helped eateries save money on discarding their shells. The Mullica River Project began in 2019. It aims to grow oysters for ecological purposes. However, it is also being studied as a possible commercial harvesting site in the future, the DEP said. While these projects do create new places to harvest and sell oysters for food, the main goal is to help improve the environment. In nature, oysters are cleaners. One adult oyster can remove pollutants from about 190 liters of water a day. So experts say they can improve water quality. Oyster colonies also are being planted along some coastlines to strengthen shores. This protects against ocean storms and rising waters. Underwater, oyster colonies can weaken destructive waves headed for the shoreline. The Global Center on Adaptation explains on its website how oyster reefs can protect shorelines. Such reefs can also create homes for other sea life and provide food for humans. On its website, the organization describes ecological restorative efforts in Bangladesh. Communities, environmental groups, and governments around the world have used oyster recycling and replanting in recent years. In the U.S., it is happening in other states. Each year in Maryland, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation turns 70 cubic meters of recycled shells a year into oyster colonies. Since 2009, the Heart Research Institute at Texas A&M University has collected about 800,000 kilograms of shells and restored about 100,000 square meters of oyster reef. Since 2015, New York's Billion Oyster Project has collected about 726,000 kilograms of shells from 75 restaurants. The organization has planted 13 oyster reefs across New York Harbor. There are similar projects in the U.S. states of Florida and Massachusetts, as well as in the Netherlands and Australia. I'm Ana Mateo.
Thousands of people across Cuba protested last Sunday in the largest anti-government demonstrations on the island in decades. Shortly after the protests began, Cuban officials blocked access to social media sites, including Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Telegram. Such sites are often used in the organizing of political protests. A London-based internet traffic observer, NetBlocks, said Tuesday that disruption of those social media services continues in Cuba. This does seem to be a response to social media-fueled protest, NetBlocks director Alp Toker told the Associated Press. Thousands of Cubans joined demonstrations in cities and towns across the Caribbean island on Sunday. They were protesting an economic crisis and the government's actions in connection with COVID-19. Some protesters called for an end to Cuba's communist political system. The country's problems have worsened since the United States increased economic and travel restrictions against Cuba during the administration of former President Donald Trump. In 2018, the United Nations estimated that America's long-standing financial and trade restrictions on Cuba had cost the country's economy $130 billion over almost 60 years. The current economic crisis has led to shortages of food, medicine, and widespread power outages. In addition, a rise in COVID-19 infections and a lack of vaccines has pushed some hospitals to the edge of collapse. Cuba's government accuses opponents in the U.S. of organizing the recent political uprising on the island. It also says the U.S. government finances their efforts. Both anti-government protesters and government supporters took to the streets on Sunday. By Monday, no large crowds were reported as security forces were deployed to the streets. Many protesters had used their phones to capture images to send to others and publish online. But internet access was restricted during the protests, and by Monday, the government was blocking most major social media sites except for Twitter, NetBlocks said. One Cuban citizen discussed the situation over email with VOA Learning English Wednesday. The person asked not to be identified because of the sensitive nature of the issues discussed. The emailer told VOA that internet access had returned in Cuba, but that the system was operating at a very slow speed. And, the person wrote, the only news and information currently available to the Cuban public is that provided by government-owned media. The individual said the demonstrations were fueled by electricity cuts, shortages of food and medicines, and long lines for buying basic necessities. The situation had gotten worse because of COVID-19 restrictions. Internet access in Cuba has been costly and mostly rare until fairly recently. Cuba was basically offline until 2008, said Ted Hinken, a Latin America expert at New York's Baruch College. He told the AP the biggest change came in December 2018, when Cubans got access to mobile internet for the first time. Today, more than half of all Cubans have full internet access, Hinken said. Since early 2019, this access has led to some smaller political events and protests being held on the island. In response, the government sometimes cuts access to social media. Hinken says it does so mainly to hide its own repressive actions. Cuba also restricts independent media within the country and routinely blocks access within Cuba to many news websites and blogs, Human Rights Watch reports. Gino Acumares lives in Havana and spoke to Reuters as he tried but failed to connect to the web on his wireless device. Our weapon is the internet. If they take away the internet, we are unarmed, he said. The government does not want people to see the truth. In other countries, government internet shutdowns before or after protests have become common. A British digital privacy research group, Top 10 VPN, estimated that in 2020, there were 93 major internet shutdowns in 21 countries. Last year, the Ethiopian government shut down internet access across the country for 3 weeks following civil unrest. The shutdown in Ethiopia's Tigray area has continued for months. In Belarus, the internet went down for more than 2 days after a disputed election in August 2020 led to mass protests. Major internet disruptions by governments have happened this year in Myanmar, Armenia, Uganda, Iran, Chad, Senegal, and the Republic of Congo. I'm Brian Lynn.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Jimmy Carter. His given name was James, but he liked to be called Jimmy. Carter was elected president in 1976. Until he campaigned for the office, few Americans knew who he was. But Carter said his lack of experience with the federal government made him the best candidate. After witnessing years of problems in the White House, many voters appeared to agree with him. However, Carter's inexperience also became a problem. Some of the issues he faced were complex, and at times, they seemed overwhelming. After only one term, Carter failed to get reelected. But in time, his public image improved. His years after leaving the White House are generally considered more successful than his time in office. Jimmy Carter was born in the southern state of Georgia. He was the oldest of four children. His father was a businessman. His mother was a nurse. The family owned a store, as well as a peanut farm and warehouse. Although the businesses did well, Jimmy Carter grew up very modestly. His family's house did not have electricity or running water. But he was hardworking and wanted to be successful. As a boy, he saved enough money to buy four houses. He earned more money by renting them to other people. He also decided to attend college at the United States Naval Academy, and in time, he did so. Carter was an excellent student, and he became a fine naval officer. As a midshipman, Carter worked on one of the country's first nuclear submarines. He later taught nuclear engineering to other crew members. But Carter's promising career in the Navy ended after only 7 years. His father was dying, and the family farm was in trouble. Carter, his wife, Rosalyn, and their three sons decided to return to Georgia and try to save it. The first years back on the farm were difficult, but in time, the business became successful again. Carter began to turn his attention to other issues. He became involved in his church, local school, hospitals, and libraries. When he had a chance to compete for a position in the state senate, he took it. As a politician, Carter developed an image as an independent thinker who tried to save the government money. He also acted and spoke strongly against racial discrimination. In Georgia at the time, many voters did not agree with Carter's support of racial equality. In 1966, even his own Democratic Party did not choose him to be its candidate to represent Georgia in the U.S. Senate. So Carter began campaigning for the office of state governor instead. In 1970, he was elected. As Georgia's governor, Carter was known as a social and political reformer. However, historian Robert Strong notes that Carter did not always work well with others in his party. Strong teaches at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. He writes that some Georgia lawmakers believed Carter was arrogant. he could appear to think he was morally right and they were morally wrong. Carter's difficulty in getting along with other officials proved to be one of the problems he would later face. But in the presidential election of 1976, many Americans seemed to like this quality. The little-known governor from Georgia defeated the sitting president, Gerald Ford. Carter won, in part, by saying that he was different than other politicians. He was, he said, a Washington outsider. Then suddenly, Carter was the biggest insider of all, the American president. One of the things Carter wanted to do was change the image of the president. Earlier leaders, such as Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson, had increased the power of the presidency. Nixon had also been shown to be dishonest and resigned from office. Carter promised never to lie to the American people, and on the day of his swearing in as president, he purposefully tried to keep things simple. He walked to the White House from the U.S. Capitol building instead of riding in the back of an automobile. His wife wore clothes that she had worn in public before. The National First Ladies Library notes that her choice of clothing sent a message of an old American value of thrift or respecting money and not spending it needlessly. What she wore was meaningful because the country was going through difficult economic times. The Carters wanted to show that the new government would work to cut costs. They also wanted to show that they were there to help the American people, not enjoy the powers of the White House. But in the end, the Carter administration received poor ratings in surveys of public opinion. President Carter had trouble dealing with U.S. lawmakers, even when his party was in control of Congress. One result was that Carter could not advance many of his ideas for legislation. He appeared ineffective. Many historians point out that, in fact, Carter had a number of successes. He helped reduce the country's dependence on foreign oil. He took steps to make the federal government more efficient and to improve the environment. He appointed a number of women and racial minorities to top government jobs, an important move at a time when many were pressing for women's rights and civil rights. And in many cases, Carter supported human rights causes, both in the United States and around the world. But the public generally did not see Carter for his successes. Instead, many Americans blamed him for the country's economic problems. Some also disliked the way he spoke to them. In one speech, Carter blamed the country's troubles on what he called a crisis of confidence. Some listeners were offended. He also decided that the U.S. would not attend the 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow. The move was meant to punish the Soviet Union for its involvement in Afghanistan, but many Americans believed the move mostly hurt young American Olympians. The administration also faced other problems. The president was never accused of wrongdoing, but other high-level officials were. So was the president's brother, Billy. As a result, Jimmy Carter's public image for honesty suffered. Then came the Iran hostage crisis. The conflict between the United States and Iran had a long history. One part involved the Shah of Iran. The U.S. government had supported his rise to power, partly because American interests wanted to control Iran's oil. But the Shah severely abused his power. Many Iranians resisted. Some wanted a leader who would more closely obey Islamic teachings. In 1979, under pressure from those Iranians and others, the Shah fled the country. By now, he was suffering from cancer. So, as a humanitarian act, President Carter permitted the Shah to come to the United States for medical treatment. The move made Iranians angry. In protest, a group of students seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, the capital of Iran. They took 90 people, including 66 Americans, hostage. Carter worked hard to get the hostages released. He tried diplomatic negotiations and economic restrictions, but his efforts did not work. Finally, he tried a secret military operation. He sent 8 helicopters and a team of special forces to enter the embassy and rescue the hostages. But that operation failed too. The weather was bad. 3 of the helicopters crashed. 8 Americans were killed. And the public's approval of Jimmy Carter dropped even more. After 444 days, the remaining hostages were released. In exchange, the U.S. government agreed to end some of its economic sanctions against Iran and promised not to interfere in the country's affairs. None of the hostages had been seriously hurt. But the crisis was the final blow to Carter's presidency. A few months before they were released, his effort to seek re-election failed. As president, Carter did not meet the high expectations he had set for himself, and he faced some unusually difficult situations. His presidency also suffered from his problems communicating effectively with Congress, the media, and the American people. But his 4 years as president did leave several marks on the office. For one, he showed that the U.S. president could help other nations and sides resolve their disputes. Carter's best-known success as president was his help negotiating the Camp David Accords. The Accords were a peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. Carter led the talks at Camp David in Maryland. Carter's efforts to protect human rights overseas also influenced the foreign policy of later presidents. In time, his work as a defender of human rights has become his most important legacy. Several years after leaving the presidency, he founded the Carter Presidential Center at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. The center seeks to prevent and resolve conflicts, enhance freedom and democracy, and improve health. In addition to his work there, Carter has helped build houses for people who need them, written books, and negotiated with world leaders to take steps toward peace. In 2002, Carter received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.